Hey, hey, Syndication Memory Club. It's time for another edition of the monthly George Ross Mastermind.
Well, welcome everyone to our monthly mastermind with Mr. George Ross. And of course, George was executive vice president in the Trump Organization for many, many years. Right-hand man to Mr. Trump, author of two best-selling books on real estate and negotiation, taught in the law school at NYU for over 20 years, in business for over 60 years. Married for how long, George?
Oh, 65. 66 now.
That's amazing.
It is amazing.
That's amazing. Great. Well, welcome, George.
Hi, good to be here.
So, George, we're living in pretty turbulent, interesting times. The stock market indices are all over the place, and today the market's off 4.5%. You've got major tech companies like NVIDIA down 23% this month, AMD down 28%. I mean, Texas Instruments lost 8% today. And we've got Treasury bills. Now the yields have gone up to at least short-term records. The thing that's most concerning is the foreign demand for U.S. Treasuries has dropped significantly. If you go back to 2009, over half of U.S. Treasuries had foreign buyers. Today, that's down to 41%, which means ultimately, if demand falls for those, yields are going to have to go up again, which means interest rates are going to go up simply because the U.S. is seen as not as good an investment maybe as it once was. I guess the question is, if these yields are going up and there's a risk premium being attached to the U.S., should we be focusing as investors on borrowing more and maximizing our leverage or selling assets and deleveraging? What are your thoughts on this next cycle? How should we prepare ourselves?
Well, I wouldn't sell out at that point. I think you can maximize your leverage at that point. It's always been my philosophy. It's worked out. Borrow as much as you can for as long as you can, as long as you have the right to prepay it.
Mm-hmm.
That's always been my philosophy, and it works out. Because if the market, if rates go up, you've solidified your position. If rates go down, you can refinance and improve your position. I think we're in turbulent times now, but I think, we just have to wait a while. I think it'll resolve itself over a period of time. You know, the effect at this point, as far as the market is concerned, the effect of what's going to happen, because with the gross, with the GNP going 5% at this, the effect of that hasn't really figured in. In other words, that hasn't turned out to be dollars for the government, but it will over a period of time. It has to be. That money will funnel back into government. If companies make more money, they're going to pay more taxes. I say they pay more taxes, they'll pay at a low rate, but there's still, the end result will be more taxes. The end result will be more income, but you don't see it yet.
Right.
So you don't have that effect. Also, there'll be a lot of money coming in from overseas now that they've permitted it to be recaptured in the United States without tremendous penalties. That also will have a driving effect. It's got to be invested somewhere. It's invested somewhere. You've got more businesses, more income, and it just hasn't gotten down to the bottom line.
So you're talking about companies.
But I think
you're talking
will.
About companies like Google and Apple repatriating retained earnings that are currently offshore in Ireland,
Absolutely.
Places like that.
Absolutely, absolutely, and there are any other company. Absolutely right. And I don't think that the effect on them. If you look at the growth factors of these of Google and that you have on Apple, and it is unbelievable. I mean, they're out of sight, and the potential is there. It's just, I think we're at a time where the market hasn't caught up with its potential, but has caught up with the actualities, and you're just in a turbulent time because of the difference in the tax structure, and also what's going on in the world makes a difference too. And you've also got to take into account at this a lot of the buyers that were there, that were foreign companies, the foreign countries that were buying the bonds, which came from Japan, from China.
Yes.
So China has a lot of it. Well, China right now, they're slowing down because of what's going on, the tension between the United States and China over the tariffs and over the trade has a lot to do with it. But that too will resolve. It has to, because China needs us more than we need China. It's hard to say that. But they rely upon the goods being bought in the United States. It just hasn't come back there yet because they're still they're still playing politics with one another. But it'll work out. I am firmly believe it'll work out. But I wouldn't go into panic selling. But you might decide that you want to sell off some stuff and reduce your holdings. But I think over the long run, it'll resolve itself. The short run, it's a roller coaster.
Very interesting. And certainly, you know, the White House has taken a very pragmatic approach with respect to Saudi Arabia. I mean, what's happened over the last 3 weeks has been ideologically a problem. And yet from an economic standpoint, cooling off relations with Saudi Arabia would be disastrous for both countries.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Well, that's a horrible thing that happened, but they need each other. They need each other. And this, I think, will come out. It will be, it's not going to filter down as far as they will think, yeah, so there's some bad apples or some people in the Saudi Arabian government or somehow. No, but that's all going to come out. And they're going to be penalized. They'll probably be tried. They'll probably be convicted. And it'll be all that. But this is just a bad circumstance that occurred. It really isn't anything that has to do with the total government.
Yep. Yeah, that makes sense.
I still think there's strong control. They've got a lot of money. They got a lot of, and they're a big a staple as against Iran, which is very important in the world.
Yeah, this is such a fascinating case study in negotiation. And you know, when I watch what's happening in the news, I'm very mindful of reading various chapters of your book and saying, okay, I see where this is going. You can really almost see the playbook play by play. It's quite fascinating.
It is. Yeah, I agree with it.
Wonderful.
But I think if we look back or look forward, if you're now following whoever is following, if they're following what the president is doing now, he is moderating his positions subtly. Can't do it drastically because he loses base. But if you look at this point, he's coming out more as he should be. Yeah, he came out vehemently against Saudi Arabia, but the people who did it, the act,
right,
not the country, which is to me is important. You can't blame a country because of one bad apple or a few bad apples.
Right. So they named 21 individuals and they're levying sanctions against those 21 individuals. But so far,
yep,
the Crown Prince has managed to save face somewhat.
Yes. Yes. And he came out and faced it.
Yep.
So it's a horrible thing. It's a terrible thing. But trust me, in two, three weeks, this will be a non-issue. It just passed off the wayside as something that happened, and it was carried because it was a horrendous act, and it captured the imagination, the minds of all peace-loving people. But it's one of the things. It'll just disappear. Unfortunate, but that's what'll happen.
We're coming up on the midterm elections. Any predictions from your end?
It's hard for me to predict. I think that it's going to come out better for Trump and for the Republicans than they had anticipated before. I don't think they're going to lose as many seats. And the reason I think that is there are two factors which filter into it. One thing that filters into it is the fact that the president is doing it, all this barnstorming. I mean, he's all over the place with all kinds of rallies, turning up his base, and people listen to him, whether they like him or not. Seeing him talk in front of all these people, they're hearing him. They may still vote any way that they want, but it is true. If you look at the fact, the Republicans are ones coming out and droving in big numbers for the election, for a midterm election, which they never had before. They're coming out in big numbers. Now, maybe they'll come out and vote Democratic, or they'll vote independent, I don't know. But nevertheless, they're energized. So that's the first element involved. The second element is involved is what has happened with the Democratic Party and how they have acted in the past a year. And I think that's turned off a lot of voters because they weren't very concerned about what the Democrats did with Kavanaugh and what they started putting on that they put on. They're not going to vote for him, no matter vote for anybody, no matter who it was. And they've been been against everything, not for anything. And they haven't really come out with a plan. What are they running on? What are they going to do? It's just, there's nothing there. So I think that these are intangibles. I don't know how it's going to affect it. And I think it depends on the locality where it's involved. So people in Texas might have one thing that they're concerned with, people in Iowa different. So it's a toss up as far as I'm concerned. But I think that it's not going to be as bad a loss as it was typically in an off period election.
Historically, voter turnout for midterm elections has been much lower. And what I've heard from some of my colleagues in Texas is that some of the numbers for advanced polling in just one day have exceeded the total voter turnout than compared with
the whole. Yes.
Yeah. It's really.
And what's scary, I mean, the difference is that the turnout is as big as it is or bigger than for a presidential election.
Yeah.
That's scary. That never happened before.
Well, I don't know if it's scary. I think it's a good thing. I think the population.
It is a good thing.
Yeah.
It is a good thing. The more people vote and the more people get involved, the better it is. There's no question about it. And which party is going to benefit by it, I don't know. But I think it's great to see that you got so many more citizens which are interested in voting for what's going on in the country in a mid-season. I think that's great.
Awesome. Okay, so let's start with the first question. Let's go with Alina. Alina, are you on the line?
Hi, Victor. Yes, I'm on the line.
Okay, perfect. Go ahead.
Hi there.
Hi, George. My name is Alina. How are you?
I'm fine.
So here's the situation. I bought an apartment complex with two partners through a syndication, and myself and another partner were involved in the capital raising part. The third partner is our boots on the ground, and he's been doing his best in terms of construction, renovations, and leasing the apartments and everything. And he's doing a decent job with that. However, I'm not that happy with the way he manages the financial component. So the fiscal management is not up to par to my standards. To give you an example, for instance, the financial statements include the income statement. However, there is no balance sheet at all. And I have spoken with both of the partners trying to convince them that things need to be done differently, especially when investors are involved. And they seem to agree with me in the conversation, but in reality, nothing is really happening. The investors, for instance, have not received their distributions last time. And, I'm looking for ways to convince my partners to not only agree with me, but also take action and, allow me to more or less take control over the situation. But I'm not.
I don't know. I understand what you're saying, but I think the basic problem with one of the partners taking control of the financial aspect. To me, that's the wrong way to. That's the wrong way to go. The wrong way to go is to get somebody who's either an accountant or a business manager, and they run the numbers. They do the numbers. Let them keep all the records and funnel the information back to the partners. The fact that you don't have a balance sheet is ridiculous. The fact that you can't do that, and also that you haven't made distributions to your investors. That's also something that's very serious. But you need an independent voice giving you the facts and the figures to the partners and let the partners decide what best to be done. You don't take somebody who's involved in construction or operation and put them in a financial capacity. That's why they have financial offices.
Right. That's actually exactly the message that I've been trying to pass to my partners. And like I said, they agree, nothing.
They agree. You got to do it. You have to do it. In other words, right now, you can't trust any of the information you're getting from the third partner. He is not a financial person.
Correct.
Because what you're telling me, he's involved in operations or things, keeping the thing right. That's fine. But every major entity that's successful has somebody that's keeping the books, a bean counter. He tells you how much you're making, how much you're losing, and also runs projections so that you know what your expenses are going to be at a given period of time and matches the income and the expenses against that. So you have an annual budget, how much is coming in or going out in a year, and then you get reports back and say, well, this is what happened this month. This was wrong. This was that. We got less income. We had an expenditure we hadn't seen. But that's the only way that you can really get a good feel for it, because you have an independent party looking at things rather than somebody who's totally involved and say, well, I should do better. I'm going to collect more. Or this time we'll be able to make a distribution. You need somebody that's purely involved in the financial aspect, but not a partner.
Right, right. They seem to agree with the message, but the action is not taken, and I'm not sure how to...
Well, you got to do it. You got to tell them. You got to tell them at this point. If not, you're going to have a serious problem with your investors. You're going to lose all credibility. And not only that, you're going to have you have a total distrust of anything that you get from the third partner. You're not going to believe anything that he says or anything, because of this. He's going to fudge and change the numbers around at that point if it looks bad. He's not going to tell you the truth.
Right.
And then so he's not going to tell you the truth. You really don't know how bad it is, because he's not giving you correct information. He's going to try to protect himself. It's the wrong thing to do. So you need, in the operation, you need total transparency. Yes, this is what comes in. This is the expenditures. This is what we do. And this is the future, how we're going to handle it in the future. Do we need contingencies? I mean, it may turn out that you, as far as the investors, you may not be able to give them a return for a long period of time. You may have to reduce the rate of return based on actual numbers, but you have to know the numbers, and they have to be certified in a way from a financial standpoint, from an accountant or what have you, that they can't be attacked. These are the facts. You can't get it now through the way you have it set up. You got the wrong person doing the fiscal management.
Yeah. Thank you, George.
You're welcome.
All right.
What's next?
Okay. Next, we have Randy Hubbs. Randy, are you on the line?
I am.
Perfect. Go ahead.
Can you hear me now?
Good.
Yes.
Hi, Randy. What's up?
Hey, I've got a question for you, because you've obviously done some very, very big deals, and I'm sure dealt with some very high up government entities. And so I'm wondering if you can provide some insight, some strategies as to how we can work our way up the ladder when it comes to having a discussion with these government officials in high places who actually have influence or decision making authority.
I understand where you're coming. The only way you're going to do it is to deal with somebody on your behalf that has the ear of the group that you're trying to work with and has been successful in the past. It's highly political. It's highly political. You cannot do it yourself unless you have the political connection and some reason for them to do business with you. They're not going to listen to you. It's not. It's unfortunate, but that's what it is. I mean, when Donald Trump did the deal on the Commodore Hotel at this point, he was 27 years old. He had somebody front for him who was well respected in the industry with the city and getting money from the city and getting the politicians in line to do what had to be done. So he was like a lobbyist, and that's what you need, somebody that has the ability to contact the organization you want and convince them why they need you and how to deal with you. Without having that connection, you're doomed for failure.
Got it.
So, for example, George, would you recommend maybe a former state representative or...
Anyone at this point. Find out who's done it. Somebody's right. Dealing with them.
Right, right.
Find out who's dealing with them. Right. You could probably do it if you got your lawyer at that point. Go through your lawyer and say, hey, who do you use to do this? Who else does it? Who's successful in dealing with the FHA or dealing with Fannie Mae or the other? Who does? Who's successful? That's the one that you need. It's strictly political.
Okay. Well, that'll be my question. See what I can come up with here.
That's it. You got it.
Thank you.
Perfect. Okay, next we've got Patrick. Patrick, are you on the line?
Actually, it'll be Matt.
It'll be Matt. Okay, go ahead.
Hey, George, how are you tonight?
Hi, fine.
So we've been looking at some deals that require significant funding to make them a reality, $10 million plus roughly. Right. We've been trying to build relationships with the type of people who are comfortably wealthy enough to find such a project. Unfortunately, we're having issues connecting to some.
Mm-hmm.
We've met some gatekeepers who tell us to come back when we have a deal, and they'll reach out to their money connection. Would it be not best for us to form a relationship with a person of wealth before asking for funds, like our current investor base, or are these people operating at a different level than us?
Well, no, you got it. This is, you know, this is the potential chicken and the egg type of situation.
Exactly.
Which comes first. The only thing that makes it work is this: is that someone that's pushing for the investors at that point has to have the track record and has to have the facility to tell your investors, look, we are giving you a special opportunity to participate if you want it. It's a limited opportunity. If you don't want it, it's okay. We got other people to do it. So you need a backup source that's going to say, okay, I'm gonna buy into it. I may take a higher return because I am the insurance policy, but nevertheless, I am there if you need the money. So it's a venture capitalist or somebody who's willing to take a short-term bigger risk until you get the investors.
Okay, so basically, we need to find a partner who's financially able.
That's what you have to do. Now, the problem that you have is unless you or whoever can say, I don't need to the investors, this is an opportunity for you to make a sound investment at a good rate of return, and it's on a limited basis. So I can't give you as much as you want. I need $2 million at this point, but I'll only give you $500,000 because I got $1.5 million from somewhere else. The lower you indicate what you need from them, the more likelihood you have to get it.
Okay.
It's strange, but that's the fact.
No, actually, I've run into that issue before where it's like, I've asked too little of amount, so they wouldn't give me the higher amount.
Yeah.
Where if you've asked the higher amount, it's more than
you have to have. But somehow, somewhere, you or somebody on your behalf has to have the big stake in the deal.
Mm-hmm.
So they say, hey, at this point, I mean, assume now that you're looking to syndicate $5 million. So you syndicate $5 million. Good. How much have you got in there? $1 million? 20% or something? You have to have it. So say we're looking to syndicate. I have 5 million. Oh, I'm putting in one. I'm 25% in there. They like that. If you have skin in the game, they will deal with you. If you don't, it's pure speculation. You have to show them exactly what you're going to do, what you're going to lose, not what you're going to, that you have such faith in what you're doing that you're ready to accomplish it. Now, sometimes what this involves is that you got to have a position where you have an option, a way to get out, or you have auxiliary funds. Well, you may have to pay more. So you pay a premium to get somebody to fill the gap while you're looking for investment.
Okay. Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's the way to do it. And then, you know what? Once you do it, you have no problem because you got them forever.
Yeah, exactly. So they get the first bunch.
They will tell, and they'll tell all their friends and everything, look at the beautiful investment I got. And when they start to see the returns and you're delivering what you said you were going to deliver, they become your best spokesman and the best testimonials you need for harvest. Then it's just a question of who you're going to keep out, not who you're going to leave in.
Exactly. Perfect. Thank you.
Yeah.
George, any thoughts on how Matt can get past the gatekeepers, or if he should even try?
I wouldn't even try at this. You're going to get past. And the only thing you're going to do is to sell them is effectively you got to show the returns. There has to be some type of guarantee, something to do it. You got to give them some type of protection. So you may, in other words, like buying an insurance policy, you have to, you say, fine, I'm protecting you against the catastrophe. Some type of the thing and say, okay, I can't, it's not a total loss. Maybe I won't, instead of getting an 8%, 6% return, I'll get a 5% return. Some protection, some safety valve that you have to get on a table. To say the worst that'll happen is this. So that they have to, if the worst is going to happen, they get nothing or they're wiped out, that's no good. If you say, okay, the worst that'll happen is your return will go down. Or I will get investors to buy you out. Mm-hmm. So one of the devices which works very well is you say to them, look, you go into my deal, but I want the right to buy you out in 3 years at a 30% increase in value. What happens is they say, well, he wants 30%. That must mean it looks good. Why should I? It must be worth more. Otherwise, he wouldn't want to buy it out. But it really shows that you have faith in doing it. Now, to the extent that you can say, sir, we'll buy you out, but you're never at that minimum of 80% of your investment, so you've limited the exposure to say it's only 20%. That could work too. So there's some way of limiting the exposure of the investor who's first coming into the transaction without having a satisfaction of your track record. He doesn't know you that well.
That's a good angle.
You got to throw something on the table. Mm-hmm. And once you do it, and it works, it's good, because you'll never have it.
And then be prepared to negotiate it away, right?
And it won't happen. What'll happen is, okay, I'm not making 8%, so I'm making 7%. Big deal. But they're in the deal. You understand? Right. It didn't turn out the way it was, but it's still not total. It's not horrible. Very rarely you have the deals that are that bad if the syndicator is good enough. It's total fiasco in a short period of time. It doesn't usually work that way.
Okay.
So what you have to do is get them in and buy time.
Okay. No, you basically got to make the deal sweet enough that it's worth the risk.
Yes. Yeah, so give them some safety now. Fine. I mean, yeah. I've had people before that I put in mortgages, you know, in mortgages. I say, hey, you know what? You don't like it. In a year, I'll buy you out. I'll give you a personal guarantee. I'll buy you out. That covers much. I have that full confidence in it. Now, it never happened. We went through it because the deal worked fine and never had to buy them out, and they didn't want to get bought out.
It worked too well.
Yeah, it didn't. True. So it didn't. So it was just, it was nice to have it, but it's like insurance. Insurance is nice, but if you don't have the loss, what good is the insurance? It's wasted money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's giving your investors or your the people who participate in your syndicate the assurance of some type of safety, which will probably never happen. And if it does happen, you can go back and negotiate. Well, it wasn't what I had, but it's not a total loss. Once you get their money invested, they don't want it back.
Nope.
It's human nature. Don't want it back.
Especially if it is working at all.
Yeah, if it's working at all. Very rarely at that point do they say, give me everything back. I'll tell you what, I'll give you half now, I'll give you later on, we'll make all kinds of terms. You can, when the catastrophe arises, if and when it arises, you can come back. And usually if you've done your homework and put it good, there's not a major catastrophe, depending upon the risk. So the market is worse, what happened, you won't get as much rental, or something came up. But it's not usually a total loss.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, George, the next question is from my business. And we have a number of local banks that are, frankly, becoming more conservative in their lending criteria. They're typically offering a lower loan-to-cost ratio compared with even 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we're starting to come across a larger number of mostly New York-based lending platforms that specialize mm-hmm. in construction loans. And that's everything from, you know, some of the bigger brand names like yep. Meridian Capital, as well as some mm-hmm. of the smaller funds. You know, a lot of them have Lexington Avenue or Third Avenue addresses. What's been your experience with these types of construction lenders, and what advice would you have for negotiating with them
there's not much you're going to negotiate with, because what they're figuring on is the return on capital that they're investing. But construction lenders are short-termers. They're not usually the end result.
Correct.
Right. So they're saying, so it costs you a little more. It's like what happens if the cost of steel goes up. It costs you more to build your building. Other costs come up. This is just another expense. The cost of getting the construction loan and borrowing at that point went up for a period of time. Welcome to the market. This is business.
Yeah.
And that's what it is, and you have to do with it, and the end result is, if you're going to add it the same way like any other cost. It happens, and it's going to happen. As lenders get nervous, depending upon the marketplace. For example, if the sale of new homes is down, the market it looks like it's down, and you've got a structural lender, you're building new homes, so they want a little more protection, so therefore they don't want to loan you as much. They want a higher loan-to-value ratio, and therefore they want a little more. That happens. Well, they may want some type of a guarantee. Now, one of the things you can do is to buy buy someone who cover the gap. In other words, you say, good, I'll guarantee that your loan, 20% of your loan, whatever it is, whatever they would be covered by having the increased loan to value ratio. At that point, you say, good, I'll cover the spread with some other guarantee. And there are companies which do that. There are lenders which do that because you know what? They don't, there's no cash exposure in the immediate. It's only in the future, maybe.
It's a contingent liability, not a
real one. That's correct. But it gives if somebody borrows money, if you can get a cosigner that's got a good bank account, banks like that. Anything that's going to solidify the risk that they envision in the construction loan, which at any time is just imaginary. You know, I mean, they say, good, we're happy if we get an 80% loan to value at this point. But are they happy if will they accept a 60% loan to value? Well, I get somebody, some other entity or something that'll cover the 20%. So if it happens at that point, if you're going to foreclose or the problem, we've got somebody that'll reduce your, that will buy back 20% of your loan. And there are a lot of companies, a lot of people do, because this is a moneymaker for them. They very rarely, you pay them something for the guarantee or the exposure, and they probably never come up with money.
And do you pay for that with cash or equity or both?
What? No, you pay with them for anything. You pay part of cash, equity, what have you. You're paying somebody to be a guarantor, and that solves your problem with the construction lender, because now at that point now you've got the loan that you want, building the building and how everything else are ending up to the end result is still the same, hasn't changed, but you've given the construction lender the peace of mind that they're not going to get hurt.
Okay, I may follow up with you after this call and see if you have a couple of names that you can
No, I'm out of it anymore. I mean, I wish I did, but I've been out of the business too long to give you any names. But there are lots of them. Lots of them. Or get a broker who handles mortgages or who gets venture capital, and they usually have the contacts that can do it. There are a lot of companies that do it because it's a wonderful business. It's like insurance business. Insurance is great if you get the premium unless you have a loss. And most of the times you don't have a loss. This is the construction lender is a paper loss. It's something that they're saying in the future. The only time they're concerned with the loan to value ratio is in the event they foreclose. If it goes good, they don't care. It's meaningless.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Good.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, next, let's see, we have Ryan. Are you on the line? Ryan, are you there? Okay, I don't think we have Ryan, so I'll ask the question on his behalf.
Mm-hmm.
So he has a construction project where he has a general contractor on the project, but no ironclad agreement in place.
Why do you mean no ironclad agreement in place? How do you go do that? And if you don't have an agreement in place, then somehow somebody dropped the ball.
That's what it sounds like. He's in a position right now where he needs to litigate against this general contractor and really for subpar work and for a magnitude of ongoing issues. And these are his words, not mine.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is what can he do here if he doesn't have a solid agreement?
If he doesn't have a solid agreement, he's going to have a big problem. If he did have a solid agreement, he'd have a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, the fact that you're doing business without an agreement in place on for a GC is just, it doesn't make sense.
It's mind-boggling, yeah.
It doesn't make sense to do it at this point. You're trusting the GC? Good. Now you found out you made a mistake. Good. You're going to eat it. You're not going to win. Its lawsuits are expensive, and they don't usually work out. And the fact that you can't pin down the requirements. You say, all right, you're going to build this. You're going to, what type of guarantees do you give? You got a 1-year guarantee or whatever it is. You're going to build it up to par, or you're going to come in on a period of time, or you're going to meet the time frame. In other words, the obligations of what the contracted GC is supposed to do and what the principal is going to pay him has to be done. in the beginning. You do, if you don't put it in place at that point, may God have mercy. Because it's you put all your faith in the person involved, and you found out you got the wrong guy. He delivered you subpar work, and you got all kinds of problems. And yeah, you that's good. But what are you going to point to and say what he did wrong? Where are the guarantees? Where did you get a 5-year guarantee, a 3-year guarantee, a 1-year guarantee? Is it backed up by an insurance company? How do I know I get what I'm paying for? The question is don't do business on that basis with somebody that you're not ready to, where you can't win, where you're relying on the good faith or the reputation of the person or the reputation of the company. No, you want to do it. We're going to do business. I want an agreement that I can point to.
Well, Ryan's situation is particularly bad, let's say. I think probably everyone on the call can relate to the situation. And if we back up from that to a more, let's say, reasonable situation, even when you, like you said, you have an agreement in place, getting rid of a GC or having selling mm-hmm. a dispute with a GC is yep, always yep. problematic.
Hey, it's not only a GC.
Right.
It's solving a dispute with anybody that you have a contractual arrangement with. That's always a problem. Litigation is expensive, it's time-consuming, it's expensive, and you have to figure out at that some point what's worth taking the loss. How much am I willing to lose as a result of it? How do I resolve it? And it basically is, how do you know you're dealing with somebody of substance or consequence? You got to look at their reputation, you look at their financial statement, you find out before you go into them how other people have dealt with them, are they honorable? At this, find out what their relationship is with the Better Business Bureau, and he satisfies that, yeah, I'm doing the right person or the right company. And you do as much as you can, and hopefully that usually that works. But if you don't do the investigation, you don't do it, then you're at your own peril.
What I liked about this question, you know, GCs have this trump card that they can play called a mechanics lien that can literally
yep.
tie you up, and so they carry more than their fair share of the negotiating leverage with that weapon. How, in your experience, how?
Yeah, it is, but nevertheless, hey, yes, that's true. But you can always bond them mechanically.
True.
So you can always bond them mechanically, and at that point, say, "Good, now you get. I got the mechanically. You're going to sue me to collect what's due to you. Mm-hmm. You can't get it out of the property. You got to get it from my insurance company. Wow, that's a whole different ballgame
right.
for them.
Right, right.
Because they can't hold you up anymore. They got to finish it. Mm-hmm. In other words, once you've bonded the mechanics lien, you don't have the lien. You can do your mortgage. You can do everything else. It's like just, I owe you money, but you don't have my property. You can't stop me from building. Yes, mechanics liens are big for a contractor, but generally speaking, only because the main party is so concerned that they can't, that they're worried about the mechanics lien, and they let the contractor effectively stymie the project. In other words, they can basically sabotage because they've got the lien, and without that you can't close and you can't finish your sale or your mortgage or your leases or whatever it is. You got this cloud on title. You can do it without a doubt later on by bonding the lien, and that's only money.
Correct.
In other words, what you do is you're putting up money or you're putting up a guarantee of a company that they're willing to pay the amount that is due in the event that they win it, but they can't, they give up the right to have a lien. And when you do that, believe me, the general contractor comes into line because now he's got to fight to get the money and prove that he's entitled to the money, but he can't tie up the completion of the property while the litigation goes on. It's a whole different ballgame. I can't tell you how many times it came on that I bonded mechanics liens, or told them now good fine, you have a mechanics lien, go foreclose the lien, but you don't get the property. You're going to foreclose it against somebody who says I'm going to pay. I'm putting up something that's the equivalent of the property. Now they end up with a main lawsuit, but they lost the leverage of stopping the job.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It's good. But many builders are overly concerned with the effect of a mechanics lien. because it does stop the job. And you can't do financing, you can't do anything. It's called lien. It's affecting the property. Mm-hmm. It's like putting a mortgage on a property that wasn't there before. But there, it's soluble by putting up some other security against.
So let's say,
which is usually a bond.
Let's say the amount in dispute is $100,000. Is there anything that prevents the GC from putting a lien for $1 million? Let's say
putting up a lien for he's got to prove it.
Right.
So that he puts that at that point, you end up in jail. In other words, he's got to prove what the lien is for. It's usually for services which are already performed, not services to be performed. So now he says, good, I put in this lumber at this point. Here are my costs. The same thing when the GC wants to get paid, he gives you an itemization or what you're paying for. And he says, good, I paid my subcontractors, I paid the others, and this is how much it is. So you give me $100,000, and I've already paid it out, or I'm obligated to pay it out. But he can't put $1 million lien on it if I've only got $100,000 worth of contract.
So
no, the GC usually just does to pay the subs.
Right. So the key is to have a sworn statement of construction, the proper AIA forms.
Of course, an architect certificate. Yeah. I mean, how do you pay the GC? You have an architect certificate that certifies that they did the work and that the degree of performance is as agreed to by the GC. So he says, good, I put in the cost of the steel that you're putting in the building is $300,000. I put in half of it and wants to make give me $150,000. But he has to certify that it's there, and there has to be an architect or a construction manager that says, yeah, that's it. And it's in writing and it's guaranteed. In other words, it's certified. It's not it's not done. By the way, I paid half. No, I'll give me a statement that I paid half. Now, if in fact that they put in half, if in fact they haven't put in half and you ask for it, that's a serious problem because that's fraud and that's criminal.
Perfect. I love it. Thank you, George.
You're welcome.
Okay. Next we have Shanna. Shanna, you're on the line.
Yes. I am here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you fine, Shanna. What's up?
Great. Thanks for the opportunity, George. My husband and I are doing our first syndication.
Good.
Prior to this thanks. I'm excited. Prior to this project, we've only done joint ventures before. And of course, in those cases, we were communicating with individual investors about individual properties. Mm-hmm. So now we're faced with a change to communicating with a group of investors. Mm-hmm. Our syndication is purchasing multiple individual condominium units mm-hmm. over a period of 6 to 12 months. So far, it's performing well, but the financials are going to be erratic for a while during the acquisition and stabilization mm-hmm. phase. I'm wondering if you have any recommendations on how to strike a balance between providing the financial information and the facts and then telling the story of how the project is progressing. We want to maintain the investor's confidence in the project. And then also I'm wondering if there's any specific areas that you suggest that we definitely include that information, or if there's some areas where you would recommend we avoid entirely.
No, that areas you avoid entirely. The first thing is you have to be frank with your investors at a point in time. And when you first start out at this point, say, good, here's what we anticipate. Here's the return you're going to get on this and all things. There are variables in what you have projected, which are there. And as long as those variables you indicate in your syndication or your papers, it's subject to changes in market conditions. So they say, okay, but they don't anticipate. Now, if you put that in there and then later on, certain things come up, you go back to your investors at this point and say, hey, you know, this things did come up. I thought you were that everything was going to come in at this price. And meanwhile, it came in more for one reason. I couldn't rent out the apartments. I couldn't sell the units. It was a longer time. It cost me more interim borrowing. Construction costs went up and therefore it changed. As long as you give them the information in an orderly fashion and it's factual, you haven't told them, they're fine. It's when you try to fudge that you have a problem. Why didn't you tell me it was as bad as it was? Why didn't you tell me this was? You lied to me. Then you have a problem. But as long as you're honest, as bad as it is, they'll stick with you.
Right. Okay. So in this case, it's not bad. It's good. And well, so far it just started. But So far, thankfully, it's good.
Good.
So in terms of telling, obviously, we're going to give facts like we purchased this number of units, we have this many under contract, that kind of thing. We can give them dates and things like that. And then do we, what amount of like narrative is interesting?
No, the lucky amount of the factual.
Okay.
We've done a telefactual. Yes, we have this amount of units. We have this amount of contracts. We're covered for this. This is what it is. We've anticipated they put up 20% of the debt. We've got an 80%. We're agreement. We've got contracts that they're going to buy. And that's factual. That's what you have. The fact that it didn't happen or will happen is a future result is not something you put in initially. You always assume everything is going to go the way you have in mind. It's going to be great. Mm-hmm. It's going to be beautiful. Hope so. Hope. Now, it may turn out to be that way. It may turn out to be better. It may turn out to be slightly worse. But that's part of doing business in real estate. That's what happens. Okay. Things can change. As long as you have a pipeline to your investors and they can trust what you say, you're all right. And the best thing you can do is to alert them before it turns out to be real bad. So now you say, look, we had anticipated we were going to make this return, but right now, because of A, B, and C at this point, it doesn't look like we're able to meet those projections. Now, you haven't not met the projections, but you've alerted them that there is there may be some change. That they're satisfied with that. They understand that they're in business and they're savvy investors. Things could change. They could go down. It happened. But they don't want to be surprised. You don't want to say, hey, by your way, your investment is worth 40% less. And all of a sudden they say, why? How didn't I know this? Why didn't you tell me? When did you know it was good? So I could make arrangements. I could decide what I wanted. Maybe I wanted to sell that investment at a loss. So it's like giving them the information that you know, and they can rely upon it. And even though it may not be totally factual or totally correct, they can rely upon it, and there's a feeling of trust in you as the party that you're giving them the fair scoop. You're giving them an honest story. It may not be as good as they had in mind, but hey, that's doing business. It doesn't always work the way you had in mind. But at least I want to know I'm dealing with an honest syndication.
Sure. So in terms of, I would in general be inclined to give a little bit of a summary of the information from my perspective, just to give them
absolutely
things are going as we expected.
Absolutely.
Kind of
feed. Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay.
And if you give it, if they are going the way it is, and periodically, like you have a newsletter to your investors, fine. Just to keep you up to everything is going according to the schedule. As a matter of fact, it's going better because we're getting higher prices than we thought. However, at that point, we have the following expenses look like they may be higher, but the end result is going to work out. That more information they give you, they'd love you for it, because they're getting information in a timely fashion. Now, I wouldn't fluff it to make it look better than it is, but no, I wouldn't do the other way to make it worse than it is. So you're now indicating trends which are taking place. And they're relying on it, saying, good, all this is the purpose of getting trust. You're not asking for money. You're not taking away money. All you're doing is telling them the nature of their investment and how it's progressing. Wonderful. That's the key of a good syndication.
Perfect. That's very helpful. Thank you
very much. So, George, related, I'm just going to build on Shanna's question here, because one of the things that's been recommended to me recently by another syndicator is this idea that when you're producing reports to investors, let's say you have three projects, you could send that custom report to each of the investors for each project, or you could send the reports for all of the projects to all of your investors. So the investors would have visibility of things that they are not currently invested in. What are your thoughts on that approach?
No, don't like it.
That's what I was guessing you were going to say.
I don't like it. No, I don't like it because you're giving the information is going to come back to haunt you. If there are projects that are not invested in and they're showing a higher rate of return, they're going to say, why am I not in that one? If it shows a lately, if yours shows a low rate of return at this point, they're not going to be, they're going to say, well, yeah, it's okay. They're going to take the best of any of those reports or those projects, and they're going to use that any way that they see fit. They're going to take the high spots or the low spots, and they're going to criticize you. Why didn't you put me in this deal, but you put me in a deal which wasn't as good? Keep them separate. Too much information from other deals are not good. This has become misleading. It's a good idea to show how good you are, but not it's not something that we generally utilized. It's not. In other words, if you have a company that has different advantages in different places, different projects, there's no purpose. Don't go through the whole company. They deal specifically, the investors in a specific project. Give them all the information on that, but not general information on the company in general. So that's my thought. I would not do that at all. It's going to make you look bad. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Or look good. Either event at this point, but that's not what you want, because it's the sort you're taking a transaction or an investment which this person or the group is not involved with and showing them this is good. The same way you'd say, well, the average return on office projects is 10%. It just is a number at that. That's no good. If your project may be less than 10% or 8%, and you can't, it also depends on where it is, the nature of the tenancies. Too many variables. So you don't want to draw that as a distinction and throw it out there.
That makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense.
And if you're getting more, or you're paying more than that, they're not going to applaud you for the fact that the average is 8% and you're paying me 10. They're not going to applaud you. They're going to say that's nice, but that's all.
Right, right, right. Okay, very good advice. Very good advice.
Okay.
Okay.
You're welcome.
Next, this is kind of a more general question, and I'm sure everyone can relate to this, and it's really a research question. When you perform research, you can really be looking for two types of information. Number one, you could be looking to actually find out the truth, or number two, you could be looking to confirm your existing belief. And mm-hmm. In my experience, actually, most people do the latter without even consciously knowing that's what they're doing. So they find confirmation of their bias, and they say, okay, I'm done. Now, you know, your experience as an attorney, I'm sure you didn't do that. How did you overcome that natural human bias, and how do you instill that in the organization?
The first part is easy. The second part is more difficult, and that is that when you in doing any real estate transaction of any magnitude, we're always involved with doing due diligence. And as attorneys that were involved, we would do our due diligence. In other words, say what's involved in connection with this transaction. And you go into the deep information as much as you can. What's going on in the area, what the mortgage are, what the vacancy rate is, what the tax rates are involved, how long it takes you to get permits, and then you come out with a total project. Say, here's the project, and here are all of the facts involved, the due diligence. And if the due diligence says don't do the project, don't do it. If the due diligence says, hey, your return is going to be too low, it's going to take you too long, then you don't do it. But you have to do the project. You have to turn over the rocks to find out where the worms are. This is what you have to do. If at that point if your belief is it's a great deal, you'll only look at whatever it takes to confirm it's a great deal. So you're not going to look at misinformation. And that's harmful.
So it's really taking that disimpassioned view at the outset until you really complete the work.
Yes. Yes. For example, at this point, I'll give you a concrete example I did on a particular project, is that in leasing to tenants, and usually they would pay their share of increases in taxes, right? That would they pay, typical. So after the building is built, if the tax goes increase at that point, you pay it as part of your rent. And came up with a different concept to say, fine, that you pay everything over $5 a square foot. And right now, the taxes on this type of building are $4 a square foot. So you make a dollar right away because it's going to be you got a higher level than is at the actuality. And I gave them a list of all of buildings in the area, the same thing, that came out at less than $5 a square foot. And these were the representatives. So I said, look at all these buildings similar to yours, and they're at $4 a square foot, and I make you instead of paying you pay your share over $4, you pay your share of $5, you got a dollar to play around with. And you know what happened? The lawyers, the ones that were involved, were satisfied because all of the information I gave them was factually correct. What they didn't know is how many buildings I knew to where the tax rate started at $5 or $6. I never gave them those, and they didn't do their independent investigation. Right? When the building was finished, the tax rate came in at $6. So instead of paying their share over $6, they paid it over $5 or a lower number, which because they convinced them that was realistic, and it wasn't realistic. So that's the question now. Find out the truth of the matter or confirm your beliefs. You have to find out the truth, which is digging in, and it's not necessarily what was there. And in that particular case, the lawyers that were involved relied upon the information they were given, which was factually correct, except it was picked. It was cherry-picked.
Yeah, it was incomplete.
It was not. It was complete.
Okay.
It was cherry-picked, but it didn't represent the market.
Right, right.
It represented specific buildings in the same area. So it said, fine. It turns out to be something, then they bought it. And you know what? Except when it finally came out, I wasn't there, but the tenants were up in arms. And the lawyers were up in arms. They were up in arms with the lawyers. Say, how come I didn't know this? How come I all of a sudden am paying increase in taxes when I shouldn't be paying the increase in taxes? So it became a hubbub, which they ultimately settled. But nevertheless, that was a result of coming up and facts that looked good on their face, but they were actually, you know, there was an error.
That's pure gold, George. Pure gold.
Yep. Okay, I think we're sure,
yes.
Right?
Thank you so much. Look forward to talking again next month. And
great. Okay.
We'll talk to you soon.
Good. Keep the questions coming.
Yeah. Great questions. Thanks. Okay. Have a great night, George.
You right. Too. Bye now.
There's another monthly edition of the George Ross Mastermind. If you've got a question for George, just send an email to askgeorge@realestateguysradio.com. Make sure you get your questions in at least 2 days before the next mastermind. Successful syndicating.